Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. At a point, I'm going to no longer be able to do shows or anything else. I mean, I'm going to start receiving burlap bags, and we're going to start filling them with sand, and we're just going to be hunkering down until it's time to bug out. And so I don't want to go through all my personal strategy, but anyway, I am here to help, and I'm not from the government. And I can't emphasize that enough. I am doing everything I can, barring going broke or anything else, because the amount of cost that we incur, it's nominal, but it's something that's not killing us. And so I'm in this position where the Lord has blessed me. I'm not rich at all. I mean, we're two shakes away from catastrophe, like almost everybody. I mean, we do have a savings, unlike most everybody, but I mean, our gazintas and gozaltas aren't what they used to be. You know, the money coming in and the money going out. That's kind of a vernacular I had with some friends at work. But anyway, let me just kind of go through some of the real quick obligatories. Oh, so on the website, on the Take Action page, the basic information, the link to Monix, and the phone number, and my account manager, which, will become your account manager. He becomes everybody's account manager, unless you want to actually make everybody that comes from your referral to be my referral, then that's fine. I mean, if you're in that situation, that you're better off than me, but you can actually set up so that when it's kind of like a, I don't want to say it's a pyramid scheme, but it is a finder fee. And so anybody that you find, I won't make the two coins on, or I won't make anything. They'll actually give, if somebody purchases, because a long time ago, I had no idea this kid was going to be, had that much money to spend, but he goes, who do you get? And I sat down, I told him about Monix, and I said, go do the due diligence, and if I'm wrong, then, let me know. But if not, then call these guys and just tell them I sent you. And he goes, oh, okay. So he calls, and he tells my, and he ends up buying a bunch of gold, spent over $10,000. And so when they spend over $10,000, Monix will give you a 10-ounce gold bullion bar. And so, it's a pretty, what's 10 ounces? I mean, 10 ounces is 200 and some dollars, but that's the current value. That bullion bar may be worth a lot more. It will be worth a lot more down the road. And so what you can do with that bullion bar, by the way, if you want to, is you can actually exchange it, because it's something you can buy for Monix. And so you can actually send it in. It has a spot price, and you can send it in and trade it or use it as a part of collateral to buy yourself some gold or some other silver or what have you. So anyway, excuse me. Sorry about that. We are in the midst of the Pennsylvania debates. We're going to get back to that. But as you know, this show is also sponsored by RepublicReview.org, and this is the only show that gives you the academic evidence and academic evidence-based solutions. Again, we have the new petition that we're going to be touching it up, but take a look at it. And if you have a state that is passing or has passed, like if you live in North Dakota and your state legislature has sold you out, your governor has sold you out, you can use this petition and you can make some minor modifications. Let us know. We'll help you. I think anybody can take this, as a PDF. You can work in a vacuum if you want to. I don't care. We all need to start actually being busy as bees, you know. And I know that we're all, we've got, you know, our life commitments and everything else. And I'm going to be telling you right now that I have no doubt in my mind where we are, that the government is now positioned to move us into a cashless society with this FedNow. And as you see this, you're going to see that life is going to go on, because it's not going to happen quickly. It won't happen July. I don't want you to think, because see, the problem, and this is how people, this is human nature. You know, when people don't realize that, you know, God is going to be coming tomorrow, they go, you know what, then I can put off my repenting and getting my life together. Quit procrastinating. It is, the signs are here. The things are coming down. I mean, we are, the crap is hitting the fan. And it is a very slow process. If you've ever been in an accident, and as you know, your mind is such a beautiful thing. And anybody that's been through an accident, you know, and they've taken the perspective of, wow, how they received all that data. You know, it's just amazing how it almost like time starts moving very slow as you're going through the motions. Now, with for some people, I guess if you're, you know, drunk or what have you, it's just like, boom, you know, next thing you know, you wake up, what happened? You're completely oblivious. But if you're fully cognizant, 9 times out of 10, most people will tell you that time slows down. And you go, it's like as you're spinning around in a circle, and even though you're spinning really fast and people are going, wow, look at, you know, it's all happening so fast, it seems to slow down and you capture almost every second. Your brain captures all of that. And I'm going, wow. So just because, you know, things aren't happening at the pace that really makes you put on haste, don't procrastinate. Start today. I've been, you know, a year ago, I started using the Now or Never, because most people started agreeing with me. It is Now or Never. Those who understood where we were and what we have to do. What we have to do is not just add water. It's not this little sponge that you add water, boom, it becomes a full sponge. It's just a little teeny thing. No, you know, it's not pull the string and it becomes a boat. No, there is some work that we have to do. And you actually have to start getting organized. To do that takes some time. And more importantly, the only way you know what you have to do, why you have to do it, you need to read this stuff for yourself, because you can't take people's word for it. Because when the time comes, you may not be able to talk to me. The communications, whatever, may be down, and you need to be able to do everything you can on your own. Your organization needs to be able to function and fire on all cylinders. I'm sorry for pounding on the desk. But that's where we are. We need you with your head in the game and acting. And everybody that listens to the show and everybody I work with, I think most people are getting it. You just need to start getting other people to listen to the show so they can start learning. Because this is why we cover the ratification debates. And I hate to go on and on and on about, you know, how bad things are, what we got to do, that type of stuff. So I'm done with the obligatories, and I'm ready to read. So, again, this is on Friday, December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. And this is Mr. Wilson, and he's been, you know, introducing some of the arguments from some of the gentlemen and so forth. And anyway, this is about the supreme law of the land and the, you know, how this breaks out and the supremacy clause. He says, there is no doubt, sir, but actually, let me kind of look ahead and see, does he mention a name? I think he's talking to the president of the convention, which I don't remember off the name, but the last name that was mentioned was Mr. Smiley. Mr. Smiley was an anti-federalist. And so Anyway, back to what he says. There is no doubt, sir, but under this Constitution, treaties will become the supreme law of the land. Nor is there any doubt but the Senate and the President possesses the power of making them. But through the treaties that are to have the force of the law, they are in some important respects very different from other acts of legislation. In making laws, our own consent alone is necessary. In forming treaties, the concurrence of another power becomes necessary. Treaties, sir, are truly contracts or compacts between the different states, nations, or princes who find it convenient or necessary to enter into them. Some gentlemen are of the opinion that the power of making treaties should have been placed in the legislature at large. There are, however, reasons that operate with great force on the other side. Treaties are frequently, especially in time of war, of such a nature that it would be extremely improper to publish them, or even commit the secret of their negotiations to a great number of persons. For my part, I am not an advocate for secrecy in transactions relating to the public, not generally even in forming treaties, because I think the history of the diplomatic corps will evince, even in that great department of politics, the truth of the old adage that honesty is the best policy. And this is the conduct the most able negotiators, yet sometimes secrecy may be necessary, and therefore it becomes an argument against committing knowledge of these transactions to many persons. But in their nature, treaties originate differently from laws. They are made by equal parties, and each side has half of the bargain to make. And actually, I'm going to take a quick second, and I'm going to read Article 6, the Supremacy Clause from the Constitution. So I'm going to go to my handy little Avalon project where I have the Constitution. I can boop, 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 get right to it. And it says right here, this Constitution, this is what the Supremacy Clause says. And everybody's focused on the treaties will become the supreme law of the land, or what it actually will go through what it says. The Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof. In other words, all laws that the federal government makes must be in pursuance to the Constitution. In other words, they just can't make a law. They can't make health care. It has to be an enumerated power. And so thereof, so in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. So in other words, which shall be made under their authority. Mr. Wilson is not clarifying that the federal government does not have general authority. He has stated that they do not have general powers, that their powers are enumerated. But in this particular context, I think it's very important to lay out the Supremacy Clause, and then when you start identifying the treaties become the supreme law, because he's just talking about the administrative mechanics and, you know, the reasons why secrecy and those types of things are critical. But I think it's more important because we have to understand that there are no such thing as general powers. That when it came down to the Constitution, this is the problem, and again, in our next episode, it's going to be a special episode for a progressive, any progressive out there, and I'm going to pick on one from social media because this is not their name, but they actually use this, you know, Archangel, whatever, that's their name. But that's really, nobody's named Archangel. As a matter of fact, I did a search, so I'm not, you know, I wanted to make sure that there was no identifiable through, you know, any kind of directory out there, this person's name. So because they're using a pseudonym, then I, you know, it's fair game. And so anybody can find this person on Facebook. But anyway, the whole point is that you have to understand the, you know, the legal layout of that constitution, because this and many people, not just progressives, but there's way too many conservatives that believe that the federal, you know, our politicians have the power. Every politician in every state house believes they have this uncontrolled, unbridled power to make any law that they want to make. And they can't. This is why the digital currency has been floating around in red states, because no state legislature has once come up and said, hey, doesn't the Constitution keep us? As a matter of fact, the constitutional enforcement of Texas, that the founder of that Facebook group, the gentleman that I approached and said, hey, look, this law you guys are creating in Texas is a violation, that no state can make any law that allows anything other than gold or silver coin to be the tender for the payment of debt. Nowhere does it say you can start changing what that. Now, that doesn't mean that the state has the power to keep private citizens from being able to make deals and exchanges. But when it comes to debt, when it comes to your mortgage, when it comes to, you know, the payment of a legal obligation, you can't bring in chickens. You can't bring in the old days, you could. You could negotiate those types of things if you wanted to, but they cannot, the state cannot make a law that allows anything other than those. In other words, the whole point was to constrain the states from going back to printing its own paper, emitting its own currency, or what have you. The state can clearly allow any two parties to come to an agreement, you know, to basically conduct business. But when it comes to the laws of the state, they cannot make a law dictating anything over currency for the tender and payment of debt. And it's that simple. And so this is why, you know, these are some crash courses, I guess, that people need to really start understanding. So we're going to get into some basics tomorrow. And so I think you're going to want to listen to this so you can share, and maybe not only just share, point out highlights of this particular conversation. Because it all will start with the fundamentals of our compact. It basically, this is going to be the same thing as that video series, but I'm going to try to condense it a little bit more. But it's basically going to be that video series to the county commissioners, because we need to start educating. So you can use those videos to the county commissioners to use for anyone, to help everybody start understanding, you know, this mysterious thing called the Constitution, because there's way too many people that think that we're supposed to support the government when there is absolutely no law. The government cannot make any law that forces us to support them. The only way they could do that is by amending the Constitution. And what they're doing is tyrannical. It's despotic. And this is the whole premise of what we're dealing with, because I hear conservatives struggle over the same crap because they don't understand the enumerated powers. There's very few that live within that box. Not even Mark Levin lives within that box. Not even Glenn Beck lives within that box. Tucker Carlson definitely doesn't. Charlie Kirk is way out of the box. I mean, I'm sorry. there are a couple of guys that kind of dance around and have the box, but they don't understand it because they've never read the ratification debates. Because as a matter of fact, I think it's Andrew Wilkow that says, our argument cannot be broken. All I need is the Constitution and you cannot shut me down. Well, absolutely you can, because John Marshall and many other people used that Constitution and perverted the words. Because there are some ambiguities, not within some of these clauses, but within this implication of power. Does Andrew Wilkow go around and say, hey, the Department of Transportation, because see, the government has the ability to create post roads, and most everybody would say, yeah, the Department of Transportation is more than legitimate. And clearly, we had three presidents that vetoed it and said that those powers don't exist, and the post roads does not grant that power. That does not mean that the federal government is responsible for the making, the establishing, to say this is where that road will be or this is where the post office will be. And so anyway, and post roads are only roads of the distribution system, not the distribution from the post office to the houses. You know, that is up to the people that are operating in that area to figure out those things and how to do that. But as far as the post roads, if that power was implied, then every street where the mailman had to drive down would have to be maintained and built by the federal government. And that was definitely, definitely not within the implied power. So anyway, getting back to what he was saying. They are made by, so he's talking about treaties are made by equal parties, and each side has half of the bargain to make. They will be made between us and powers at the distance of 3,000 miles. A long series of negotiation will frequently precede them. And can it be the opinion of these gentlemen that the legislature should be in session during this whole time? It well deserves to be remarked that though the House of Representatives possesses no active part in making treaties, yet their legislative authority will be found to have strong restraining influences upon both the President and the Senate. In England, if the King and his ministers find themselves during negotiations to be embarrassed because an existing law is not repealed or a new law is not enacted, they give notice to the legislature of their situation and inform them that it will be necessary before the treaty can operate that the law be repealed or some be made, and it will not be the same and will not the same thing take place here. Shall less prudence, less caution, less moderation take place among those who negotiate treaties for the United States than among those who negotiate them from their nations of the earth? And let it be attended to that even in the making of treaties, the states are immediately represented and people immediately represented to of the constituent parts of government must concur in making them. Neither the President nor the Senate solely can complete a treaty. They are checks upon each other and are so balanced as to produce security to the people. The only contention I have with what Mr. Wilson stated here is that he didn't emphasize, like he did earlier, that the government only has these enumerated powers and they can make no treaty that is not within their authority. So can they make a treaty regarding energy? No, they cannot. Where in the Constitution is energy delegated? It's not. So that means that every treaty that they've made regarding energy, the transfer of energy, or those types of things, it's one thing to make a treaty over commerce. But it's another thing, like carbon, you know, trades and those types of things, they have no ability to do. So they can make treaties regarding commerce. That is a power that they have. But energy itself, like carbon footprints and carbon credits and establishing carbon limits, they don't have that authority. So, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, really simple. I don't want to marginalize it, But it is as simple as, is the power enumerated? If the power is not enumerated, then they can't do it. So they can do things on the end of commerce for the exportation and importation of things. They can make those types of treaties, but they have to be delegated that power. We'll be right back.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so when it comes to general commerce, they cannot start specifying what type of commerce a state can buy other than if it is from a friendly nation or not. It's the same thing with the exportations. I mean, so the federal government does have the ability to keep us from dealing with, and the policy was to be open and not to create alliances. However, they did realize that they had to have restraints with bad actors such as Islam and the Ottoman Empire. And so as we look at how they managed commerce and how it was done in a general form, this is why they did not dictate what the states were doing and how the states chose to move their economy forward. You got to remember, the federal government has no enumerated power over our economy. None. Each state has its own economy, and each state needs to tend to its own economy. As a matter of fact, the fact that all the people are so heavily invested in New York State and the New York Stock Exchange. Well, that's a lot of other states' money sitting in the state of New York. Folks, it would be wise that every state create its own stock exchange and abandon the New York Stock Exchange, unless that's where you want to be. But to be clear, you have no underwriting and or no protection. And this is where, when we start really looking at the layout of the Constitution, do we think it is prudent to give the federal government, the guys that have weaponized all of this stuff, do we think it would be prudent to actually let them legitimately have those powers? Heck no. Therefore, what is the best, path forward? What do we need to do moving forward to basically secure a system, so that people have some level of protection, but not necessarily the draconian measures and or the tyrannical opportunities of a centralized government? And I am here to tell you that is something that we have to talk about. And this is really simple. There is no reason why, and anybody that understands the Constitution understands the one little twist that needs to be done, but there is no reason why the states do not create separate polities to be able to handle very specific things, such as the finance. We look at these departments that were established, like the Department of Transportation or Infrastructure. let's not call it Department of Transportation. We're going to call it infrastructure. And we're going to, everything that has to do with infrastructure, from aviation, communication, highways, waterways, everything, power, you know, power transmission lines that go from one state to the other. All of these things, it's infrastructure. Even, you know, water, if we start moving water, because why not water? Why are we not moving water around the states to help provide, you know, so that every other state has the opportunity? But the United States government should not be the government that's delegated that power. There's no reason why the states can't create an inferior, or I should, because the federal government is inferior. Do not think that it is superior. There's no reason why the states can't create another inferior government to actually manage the interests and strategies of our own infrastructure and let them do that. And then we can say, is education a part of infrastructure? No, I don't think so. I really think that, you know, we don't have to have 50 departments of, you know, or these little commissions, but we do want to isolate them so that their focus, just like the federal government's focus, is external. External for doing treaties, doing war, you know, and commerce with external, not internal. And as a matter of fact, if we do go down that path, and we have an economic polity that we create, we'll be able to strip the federal government of regulating the commerce amongst the states. In other words, that can easily be dissected out of the U.S. Constitution and granted to the states to have their own power over that. Now, as we start distributing this responsibility and moving it from one body to another, to a new body, it makes it harder. Because when you centralize everything into one body, that is, and as Jefferson talked about political energies, he basically talked that the common political energy of most all governments that have general powers is to centralize their power. We have a distributive power. We don't have to centralize into one. We can create multiple centrals. We have the central for our external and for our currency, taxation, and those things. And let's leave it with that. And then what we can do is we can create a new polity. And as that polity is created, we would basically create an amendment to the U.S. Constitution to say that the federal government will have to support the budget. So in other words, because they're the ones that do the taxes and we need to have them do the tax. So we want to maintain those things that were designed in the U.S. Constitution, but a few of the things that had some domesticness to it, we need to probably move away and actually delegate that to a new polity. The danger in making a single central government, they actually start consuming all, and they centralize, and they change the flow of political energy from distributive out to the local to actually pulling everything to where they start making decisions on everything. How much water your toilet can flush, you know, how much energy your light bulb can consume. All of these types of things are always better to allow the state and local governments. And this is why, by actually distributing things as much to the county government, we can reduce most of all our government to where it doesn't become these monoliths. And what we want to do is maintain a very limited powers to that. In other words, maintaining a strategy so that we, you know, we're all working in the same direction. And it's easier to do that when you limit powers than it is when you centralize powers. But we can't have the unanimity or the unanimous decision where it takes everybody, because we'll always have a rogue island and we'll be stuck. So anyway, let me just move back on to, and the next step is money. And we're going to be talking a little short little quip here. This is from, again, yep, it's Wilson. It's the same day, December 7th. And this is what he says. I'm afraid that bribes in government may be offered and received. But let me ask the gentleman, because let me read the precursor to this. As the objection that the House of Representatives may be bribed by the Senate, I confess I do not see that bribery as an objection against the system. It is rather an objection against human nature. I am afraid that bribes in every government may be offered and received. And I'm going to pause here. This is what I've been telling you about, that your state legislatures through the Freedom Caucus and through other different organizations, when there's money that flows through it, that is he who pays the piper calls the tune. You receive money and they call you and say, hey, I need you to do this. You are inclined and actually you feel the pressure that you need to do that, or they're not going to be helping you. They're not going to be funding you anymore because they're going to find somebody else to do the job. And this is why we want to strip, you know, all of those types of things out of this system. I mean, we really did. When they created the Constitution, they finally got rid of the ability to buy alcohol, you know, for buying votes. But the problem is that they allowed these politicians to use services to buy votes. It violated the Constitution, because that's what Obama and Hillary and all of these progressives says. If you vote for me, we're going to give you health care. That's illegal. That's bribing. What's the difference between a drink of alcohol and giving somebody free services? It's illegal. But there's been this ecclesiastical whiteout in everybody's mind that, you know, only alcohol is the evil thing. But, you know, hey, healthcare, that's a good thing. No. Politicians have enumerated powers and they cannot use politics as well as bribery to getting you to say, we'll do this, we'll violate the Constitution if you vote for me, because you'll let us violate the Constitution, right? And that's how we've had a mob rule in destroying our own Constitution. It has been an insidious ride that has been the permeation of communism and these evil ideologies that have come into America. And it's time, folks, that we just start recognizing that we are a part of the problem. The way we see things is a part of the problem. We have to start, you know, I don't know if you saw the video with the Democrat, you know, talking to the doctor that, you know, they just had to have a procedure done where they had to remove his head from his rectum. And so, you know, and that's the problem. People have their heads up there, and we need to actually start realizing government only has these powers. And the only way they can be doing something, we need to get 38 states to actually buy off on it. That's why 13 states is the sanctuary of despotism. So anyway, so back to this, every species of influence is guarded against as much as possible. Can the Senate procure money to effect such design? All public monies must be disposed of by law, and it is necessary that the representatives originate such law. Before the money can be got out of the treasury, it must be appropriated by law. If the legislature had the effrontery to set aside £300,000 or £400,000 for this purpose, and the people would tamely suffer it, I grant it might be done. And in Pennsylvania, the legislatures might do the same, for by a law, and that comfortably to the Constitution, they might divide themselves among what portion of the public money they pleased. I shall just remark, sir, that the objections which have been repeatedly been made with regard to the number of representatives being too small, and that they may be possible be made smaller, that the districts are too large and not within the reach of the people, and that the House of Representatives may be bribed by the Senate. come with an oncoming degree of impropriety from those who would refer us back to the Articles of Confederation, for under these, the representation of this state cannot exceed 7 members and may consist of only 2, and these are wholly without the reach or control of people. It is there not also greater danger? Is there not also greater danger that the majority of such a body might be more easily bribed than the majority of one not only more numerous, but checked by a division of 2 or 3 districts of independent parts? The danger is certainly better guarded against in the proposed system than any other yet devised. And that was his argument regarding the money and the use of money in politics. However, when we have grown and they have figured out that collusion between the House and the Senate to grant themselves money, hey, we could do this if you do that. And this is where politics, unconstitutional politics, have pushed America down the wrong path. Remember, they can't be making agreements and they can't be doing anything that's not within the enumerated powers. But when they make this, if we agree and we do it, who can stop us? And then what we'll do is we'll get the Supreme Court to rule to say, well, they thought it necessary and proper, and that's within the necessary and proper clause, that they can make all laws necessary and proper. Folks, we have been bamboozled. The only way we understand the truth of how the Constitution is so well defined is via these debates. It is only reinforced. I mean, I can say these things, but it is only reinforced with their words, and their words are far more powerful than myself. Now, the next one is about the president, and this is Mr. Wilson again, and this is the last one for the day, and then we dive into the evening. If the gentleman will look into this article and read for themselves, they will find that there is no well-grounded reason to suspect the president will be the quote-unquote tool of the Senate. Quote, the president shall be the commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states. Now, just to be clear, what is the Army? The Army is not the United States Army. The Army is the federalized militia. They're not to have a standing army. They're not even to, an army's not supposed to exist unless there is a need for Congress to call forth the militia and use them. And they can only do so by 2 years. But the question is, these people that come in must come in via the militia. The federal government has an army and has direct recruiting. They don't come in from the states. I mean, they have these things called AFES, Armed Forces Entries Exam Stations, and I don't know what they call them now, but that's federally ran, and it's by the Department of Defense, and it is not the militia. It's not coming from the militia system and so forth. And so these people are, this is a mercenary army. And we have to shut the U.S. Army, U.S. Air Force, Space Force, all of these other forces down and force them back into. And I think we should actually look at amending the Constitution to basically stating that if an army is to be created, if we're to federalize the militia to a U.S. Army, it would be put underneath the Navy. Because how's it going to get anywhere? Back in the old days, how did the Army actually go fight a war in Europe? How did they fight a war in Asia? Well, they all went down to the beach and they started, getting their boxes out into the water floating, and they started pushing all that stuff. No, they had the Navy. The Navy got them there, and the Navy supported them, they did the logistics and everything. The Navy is basically the force of projecting deadly force. The Army was a very limited federalized militia that had two, three roles that were assigned to it in the Constitution: executing the laws of the Union, suppressing insurrections, repelling invasions. And so when we really start looking at, you know, how we have been, you know, I'll just say perverted in, you know, accepting all of these vestiges and all these little, you know, stovepipes of government, you know, from the Department of Transportation to the Department of Homeland Security, all of these things violate the Constitution, all of them. This is why over 90% of the federal government spending goes away. 90%. And actually then goes to spend on the things that they should be spending. They shouldn't be spending money on social programs. They have a responsibility to actually spend on, you know, the strategic interest of defending us and protecting our sovereignty. They don't have the ability to actually sell our sovereignty out to where we're no longer a sovereign nation. That's what they've been doing, folks. I hate going back down these little rat holes, but it just always points out when we go through these ratification debates what they're supposed to be doing and how our government is actually committing warfare against us. So anyway, let me get back to this. And he says, the president may require the opinion in writing of the principal officers in each of the executive departments upon any subject relative to the duties of their respective offices. And he shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States. Must the president, after all, be called the tool of the Senate? I do not mean to insinuate that he has more powers than he ought to have, but merely to declare that they are of such a nature as to place him above expression of contempt. There is another power of no small magnitude entrusted in this officer. Quote, he shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And that is the true mission of the President of the United States, is to ensure that the constitutional laws are being faithfully executed. We have a president today who is exercising and engaging in direct warfare against the Constitution, the states, and the citizens. And as radical as this may sound, this is all founded on these ratification debates and the framers. Because the framers clearly said they don't have the power to do these things. So who's right? Do we believe the commander in Dolt, or do we believe the father of the Constitution and these framers who debated and basically formed this Constitution by the divine hand of providence? I think everybody knows what the true answer is. Now, that was the last comment. It actually wasn't. There was plenty of other things, but that was kind of a little bit preceded before they took a break. So they took a break for the day. And then in the evening, in the afternoon, they met. And the first topic that, you know, came that of interest that we want to cover is jurisdiction. So there's kind of like, okay, we're getting back in, you know, in functioning and so forth. So now Mr. Wilson is bringing up his point of contention regarding jurisdiction. And this looks to be judiciary jurisdiction and jurisdiction of the federal government. Trial by jury forms a large field for investigation, and numerous volumes are written on those subjects. Those who are equally acquainted with it may employ much time in its discussion, but in a country where its excellence are so well understood, it may not be necessary to be very prolix, prolix, and I may have mispronounced that. In other words, verbose, wordy, long-winded. It's just another word for verbose or long-winded. In pointing them out. For my part, I shall, and you know what? These guys are prolix, right? I mean, they're very long-winded when it comes to some of the topics they cover. But anyway, for my part, I shall confine myself to a few observations in reply to the objections that have been suggested. The member from Fayette, Mr. Smiley, has labored to infer that under the Articles of Confederation, the Congress possessed no appellate jurisdiction, but this being decided against him by the words of that instrument by which is granted to Congress the power of, quote, establishing courts for receiving and determining final appeals in all cases of capture, he next attempts a distinction and allows the power of appealing from the decisions of the judges, but not from the verdict of a jury. But this is determined against him also by the practice of the states. For in every instance which has occurred, this power has been claimed by Congress and exercised by the courts of appeal. But when they be consequence of allowing the doctrine for which he contends, would it not be in the power of a jury by their verdict to involve the whole Union in war? They may condemn the property of a neutral or otherwise infringe the law of nations. In this case, ought their verdict be without reversal? Nothing can be inferred from this to prove that trials by jury were intended to be given up in Massachusetts and in all the eastern states. Their causes are tried by juries, though they acknowledge the appellate jurisdiction of Congress. And he was talking about under the Articles of Confederation. And the point that he brings up with Massachusetts, if you understand before the Tea Party, before things really got out of hand, there was the Boston Massacre. What happened? Well, what ended up happening was if I remember correctly, it was four British soldiers that ended up killing a person. I think there's maybe one or two people killed. They called it a massacre, but it was a massacre of a person. And the essence of what happened was that these four British soldiers were then tried. And they were tried by the people of Massachusetts in that court. And they were found guilty, and then it was actually John Adams defended them, and I think he actually got them off. But had they been found guilty, it would have actually risen up to, I believe at that point in time, it would have been Continental Congress or to an appellate case. And the design was to ensure that if that was France, if it was Spain or something else where we actually convicted their people to, you know, a state was able to convict, you know, a person to a criminal charge and not have an appeal at the national level, then the other state, which would be France, Spain, or what have you, would say, well, we find that an insult, you know, and would declare war against the state of Massachusetts. This is why the federal jurisdiction, when it came to dealing with foreigners, why it was critical that they protected not just the states, but they also protected the citizens. And that's right there in Article 1, Section 8, that we're all under their jurisdiction when we travel abroad or dealing with foreigners here in America. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic.
We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and Republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.